Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is July 12, 2017, a very bright and sunny and very hot day here in Nashville. If you read the newspaper in Nashville, especially the Nashville Scene, you will be aware of a current controversy that has to do with Fort Negley Park. The park, of course, is the site of the ruins of a Civil War army fort that was built on top of St. Cloud Hill. The park has also been the location of Greer Stadium for the last many years, the home of the Nashville Sounds Minor League Baseball Club. The Sounds have now abandoned that stadium in favor of a brand new stadium downtown. The city has proposed to make the area where the ballpark and adjoining parking lots have been available for a mixed-use development. Park advocates, particularly the Friends of Fort Negley organization, have announced their opposition to this conversion of park use. I wanted to do a program about Fort Negley and learn more about the history of the site and the nature of the resource which is there. And so our guest tonight is Zeta Law. Zeta is an archaeologist and the director of the Fullerton Laboratory for Geospatial Studies at Middle Tennessee State University. Zeta has been involved in the study of this unique site for many years, dating back to its original master plan, which was done in 1996. She continues to be involved as the site is the topic of her developing dissertation. So, I sure hope you'll enjoy our interview with Zeta Law. Zeta Law, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really great to have you.
Thank you.
We're going to talk at some length today about the Fort Negley property here in Nashville, which is a Civil War era fort that was built by the Union forces during the Civil War. And I want to ask you in great detail about that. But first, tell us about yourself. You're presently at Middle Tennessee State University.
Yes, thank you. I'm the director of the Fullerton Laboratory for Geospatial Science.
And that's those are fancy words for what exactly?
Well, we do geographic information systems and remote sensing. Basically, we do mapping. Mm-hmm. And while our graduate students do a lot of different things, I'm more interested in historical geography and mm-hmm. mapping historical subjects.
Right. So your background is in archaeology. I noticed that you're a graduate of Indiana University.
Yes, I am. I got my undergraduate degree at Indiana University in anthropology and my master's degree from University of Wisconsin in anthropology and archaeology.
Right. And so you've been in private practice as an archaeologist for some time before going to MTSU?
Yes, before I went to MTSU, I had a consulting practice in archaeology here, and before that in Nashville, and before that I worked for the Tennessee Department of Transportation as an archaeologist. And I also worked at Department of Archives and History in Mississippi as an archaeologist as well.
Terrific. You know, you're a busy person. In preparation for today, as you do with persons that you have not met, you look them up on the internet. At first I thought there were two people in Nashville named Zeta Law. One, the archaeologist, historian, and the other, a musician. So you have another interest in your life, and that is dulcimer music. Is that right? Tell
That's
us about
exactly
that.
That's exactly right. Okay. Well, thank you. I went on my first archaeological excavation at age 16, and my roommate in that session had a dulcimer, and I just fell in love with the sound of the dulcimer and the sound of Joni Mitchell playing the dulcimer. And I got interested in playing the dulcimer, got a dulcimer shortly after that, and so I've had these dual interests, but they kind of intertwined, archaeology and playing the dulcimer.
Isn't that fun? And you're associated with Blair School of Music as well.
Yeah, I'm an adjunct artist instructor of Appalachian Dulcimer at Blair School of Music in Nashville.
Well, we'll probably have to have another session just to talk about music.
That's
and
wonderful.
Instruments and that sort of thing. But today we're here to talk a little bit about Fort Negley. How did you get to Nashville, though? I mean, from the north.
My husband is a psychologist and had to do, he got his PhD at Indiana University. I was working in the Glenn Black Lab of Archaeology at the time there at Indiana University, and he got an internship at University of Mississippi Medical Center. And we weren't too sure about moving south of the Mason-Dixon line, but we did, and we fell in love with the South. And we fell in love. We were living in Jackson, Mississippi. I worked for Archives and History in Jackson. And then he got a job at Vanderbilt University. And so I did follow him. And, you know, it took a while before I got a job at TDOT as an archaeologist, but we have been in Nashville for over 30 years, and we really love
terrific,
it.
Terrific, terrific. That's about as, maybe I've been here maybe just a few years longer than that, but that's the same story with me. All right, let's talk about Fort Negley. How did you first become involved with learning about Fort Negley?
You know, I became involved with Fort Negley in my private consulting practice, and I was asked to be the consulting archaeologist on the development of the master plan for Fort Negley Park. That came out in 1996. So that was a plan that was supposed to document the fort and document the existing conditions and make recommendations for going forward with opening the fort and the park up to the public. We did that for Nashville's Board of Parks and Recreation, and that has been, for the past 21 years, the guiding document of Fort Negley Park. A supplement was issued in 2007.
Okay. And you actually did a doctoral thesis on the park, is that?
I'm working on a doctoral thesis on the park.
Okay, all right. I noticed that that's something that you're working on now. Okay.
Yes.
Right. So, what is Fort Negley?
What is Fort Negley? Fort Negley is the largest inland masonry fortification built during the Civil War, built by the Union Army during the Civil War. It is a what we call a polygonal or star fort. If you looked at it, it looks like a rectangle with basically Marge Simpson's hair on the side of it. It has stars on each side and bastions. So best way to look at it is to see it from the air to see what I'm talking about. It was designed by architect James St. Clair Morton, Captain James St. Clair Morton, who was West Point trained. And I have looked through a lot of West Point documents, and I've never seen what we call a star fort, a polygonal fort, in the exact same shape as this one. So I think this may have been his design, although we've looked at his papers and we really haven't seen anything. He was killed at Petersburg during the Civil War, so he wasn't able to go on and write a memoir. But
so about what year was this done?
Oh, this was done in 1862, August of 1862. Okay. So in February of 1862, Nashville was occupied by the Union Army. Fort Donelson fell, Union soldiers came into Nashville, and Nashville became an occupied city early in 1862. In August of 1862, James St. Clair Morton, who was stationed here, he was told, you know, to go ahead and fortify the city, to make it a very fortified city. And in fact, it's been said that Nashville was the most heavily fortified city, Union occupied city, during the Civil War, second to Washington, D.C. So if you're in Nashville, there's remnants of Civil War earthworks all around the city.
Sure.
So entrenchments, that's what I mean when I say earthworks, entrenchments. And then there were a series of forts ringing the downtown of the city because Nashville was occupied. It was a Confederate state that the Union Army had occupied. So it wasn't the people in Nashville, not all of them necessarily welcomed the Union Army in their presence.
What would have been there during the time of the occupation, it was a garrison there?
During the occupation. So during the occupation, the fort has three levels. It has the bastion levels, which are gun emplacements. Then it has an area of what we call the Redan Ditch, and it circles the palisade area or the stockade area. And in that, there were garrisons, there were winter quarters for soldiers who were garrisoned inside the fort. Then at various periods of time outside the fort, on the north side of the fort, there were also soldiers in tents garrisoned there. So you had people constantly inside the fort. And we have a drawing of the fort from a soldier who was stationed there in 1862, shortly after the fort was opened. He describes the telegraph wires being mounted in the fort. And so he made a handmade drawing in his diary. We have the diary at the Tennessee State Library and Archives, and it shows where guns were emplaced at that time. It actually shows the location of a well.
Okay.
And he did not draw in the soldiers' quarters, but we've done some archaeology there and found evidence of the winter quarters, and then on historic photographs from the Civil War period, you can see the tops of the Sibley tents and the other structures there.
Who actually did the construction?
Well, it was a combination of the Union soldiers and African Americans.
Okay.
The Union soldiers, the Union Army conscripted, or what the term from that period is called impressed, free blacks, and also went around to slaveholders and impressed their slaves to help build that fort. This started in August of 1862. It was finished by October of 1862. So it was very hot work. There is
So just two or three months?
Yes, it was constructed very quickly. One of the people always ask, where did the rock come from? And one of the accounts we have from that period, an old soldier who came back and his account was in a newspaper, he said, we dug the rocks from the top of the hill.
Okay.
So prior to the Civil War, the land was owned by the daughter of Judge John Overton, who owns, he was a plantation owner in Nashville. And it was a really high hill. It's one of the highest hills in Nashville, which of course makes it perfect to put a large, imposing fort on top of. But prior to that, it really didn't have a lot of use. People talk about it as being useful for being used for picnics. It's not a place that you could really, you couldn't graze cattle on easily. It's a steep hill.
Steep hill.
Which again makes it ideal for a fortification.
Right.
It was rocky, so it did have that, whereas other forts, such as Fort Rosecrans, which is also designed by James St. Clair Morton, that's in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, it's made out of earth.
Okay.
But this one, he used the natural material
the
natural limestone that's right on fort. And in fact, coral deposits on that hill, on St. Cloud Hill, that's the name of the hill, go back to 500 million years ago.
As fossils?
As fossils, yes.
Okay, so there's an interest in collecting and fossils there on that site as well, because there's evidence on the backside of some looked like quarry activity.
There actually is quarry activity there.
Yeah.
We know for sure it was quarried in the 1930s. So that leads me to the next period in the fort's history,
okay.
Next major period in the fort's history. In 1928, the city's Board of Parks purchased the land from descendants in the Overton family to restore the Civil War fort. So this is 50 some years after the Civil War. There's a lot of interest in commemorating the Civil War during that period and to create a parkland. So what we have then the Depression happened, And then the WPA, Works Progress Administration, came along and had basically grants for cities to do public works projects. And so Nashville applied for and got a grant to proceed with restoring the Civil War fort and creating some little softball diamonds and some other parks features. Now, what we see from that period is we see in historic photographs, we see what's clearly a quarry that the WPA era people were quarrying out the side of the hill to create rocks, to create stones, to rebuild the fort. They probably used some of the existing stones that had remained from the Civil War. But they probably also got, well, we know that they also quarried new material. Did they quarry in the same place that the Civil War soldiers did, and the African Americans who were impressed? Well, it's hard to know because they took that evidence away. So that's hard to know. But
did the WPA folks build that decorative gateway that's there?
Yes, the decorative gateway was built by the WPA, and it's a really beautiful example of WPA stonework.
Sure,
we have many examples throughout the city of WPA stonework, and you can clearly see if you walk through this fort today, it's basically a ruins of stoneworks, but you can still see the outline of the fortification. You know, the walls vary from like 12 feet high to just a couple of feet high, depending on how much soil is around it. But you can see these days evidence of where the WPA pulled the dirt back to try to find the original walls. You see the little berms around the walls, and they were trying to find the original walls of the Civil War fort. And there's a very interesting article in one of the newspapers of the period that says, you know, the headline is "Workers Unearth Walls of the Original Fort Negley," and you see them digging down. So if we go back to the Civil War, the fort was garrisoned until basically 1867, 2 years after the war ended, but there were a lot of things that had to be done in Nashville after the war, including selling off surplus material. And if you look through a lot of the newspapers from that period, which are really easy to get to now, the Library of Congress, you can see that they were selling off surplus material. Now, what happened to the rocks? What happened to the stones that Fort Negley was built from? Well, some people say that people took them to build the Nashville Reservoir. I don't know if that's actually true or not. I've not found any primary source documentation of that. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it is. I'm sure that people scavenged some of the stones there for foundations. And I mean, I'm just sure because being trained in anthropology, I'm using ethnographic analogy. I'm using how people work, how people behave. They would certainly have scavenged the stones. And if you look at pictures from the 1890s of the fort, kind of looks like stones and mounds of dirt, like it's come down. Certainly they took down the wood stockade that was in the center of the fort.
Okay.
They took that down and sold that for surplus. But you know, the rest of the stones it's hard to know what happened to them exactly. However, archaeology that was done in the early 1990s there has told us that a lot of pieces of this Civil War stonework still remain underneath the surface.
And this is archaeology from digs, or this is some sort of sensing you're using?
No, this was actually excavation.
Okay.
It was done by Nashville's Metro Historical Commission, contracted by Metro Historical Commission, and they did it because they wanted to know how much of the Civil War fortification was there, if there was anything left. And they found a cistern. We've also found the original flagpole location.
Interesting.
And entrenchments, the wall trenches from the stockade, that's still up there. And it's all really fairly fragile. It's close to the surface. And at this point, it's just features. Artifacts are gone. The people have been hunting this site for artifacts since well, since after the Civil War. Right. And I'm sure that during the WPA period, it was scoured for artifacts,
sure,
too.
Sure.
And in some of the archaeology that we've done, looking for evidence of the federal encampment, we've encountered a lot of looting pits from that. So it has been looted for years, and we haven't, in the archaeology that's been done, we haven't had very many Civil War artifacts show up.
So we're jumping back and forth a little
bit
chronologically, but the city has recently done some work to sort of enhance the visitor experience there. They've made some pathways to go up to the top, and they've done some interpretive signing and that sort of thing up at the top of the fort, and they've built a visitor center there recently. When do you remember when that was built?
Yes, the visitor center was built in 2007.
Okay.
The pathways were done in 2004. I was the archaeologist
on
that project.
Good for you.
I was the archaeologist on the design team for that project.
Okay.
And remember I told you that, I just told you that some of the archaeology is very fragile underneath there. One of the things about that I think I'm very proud of that Nashville did is that all of those boardwalks there are floating boardwalks. They float on a bed of heavily packed gravel.
Okay.
There's no impact to the archaeologic resources in the ground at all there.
Terrific.
The design of it, I didn't design it, I just gave my wishes, like I wish this could float.
Yeah.
And the architect that designed it did a very good job because it's 13 years later and this gravel has held up. The wood has not held up as well as the gravel that it's set on. But it was all designed so that there would be no impact to any of the archaeology and that people could see it. And that we could do archaeological excavations in the future if we wanted to.
Now the site is a couple hundred acres in total. The now includes the remnants of what was Greer Stadium. For those that are not from Nashville, Nashville's had a minor league baseball team for many years, the Nashville Sounds, and Greer Stadium was their place that they played, and it was on this very same property.
Yes.
And now the Sounds have built a new stadium downtown, brand new, nice looking stadium, and what sits there now is kind of the remains of Greer Stadium. It's I was out there the other day, and it's pretty shabby looking at this point. And I guess the city is considering what to do with this property where Greer Stadium is, and there's a parking lot back behind. So what in the Civil War era would have been on the property where Greer Stadium sits today?
In the Civil War era, there's maps from that and pictures of that shows a couple of structures in that area.
Okay.
And I don't know what those structures were exactly, if they were associated with the railroad. That was part, in that area, is part of the field of fire. It was part of the area that was being used to as sight lines to the railroad to be able to protect it. Now, it's really interesting because there is one photo that shows like just a little shack or something, and it looks like it's from that era. And I've been told that is a dwelling of someone who was possibly working on the fort. And it's hard to know, you know, because the photographer doesn't leave detailed notes about what they saw and who they interviewed at the time. But yeah, the maps show that there were some structures in that area.
So then when it came into the ownership of the Board of Parks and Recreation, and then the WPA came in, was the WPA involved with building the earlier ballparks that were there?
Yes, the WPA built the earlier ballparks. So when there's a 1932 U.S. Geological Survey map that shows a number of structures on the side of the hill there, basically in the area where the stadium and its parking lots sit now.
Okay.
We think those were probably cleared out to build that, because when in the ownership, in the discussions, the park board minutes, it says that, yeah, there's people living there on a month-to-month basis.
I see.
So, you know, if they needed to be cleared out, it wouldn't be a problem because they didn't have long-term leases. So then the WPA built four tiny little softball fields, and then a bit of a larger, hardball field, which may have been used as a Golden Gloves stadium. And what they did is they built the stadium bleachers back into the side of the hill. And you actually can see a remnant of that larger stadium, that hardball stadium. That exists in a sliver of trees in the parking lot today. There's little stair steps, stone stair steps, that are clearly stadium steps, and that match with the photographs from the aerial photographs from the 1940s and 1930s. What they probably did, since this was a slope of a hill, they built the stadium back into the hill and use that material to level out and make level playing fields. And then if you get near the railroad on that side and start going down the slope of the hill, you see three tiers of WPA stonework of retaining wall, holding that wall back.
That's so interesting. So before we went live in our conversation and recording, we were talking about the cultural importance of Fort Negley, and you used the term that it was kind of like an Ellis Island.
Yes.
What do you mean exactly?
So I did not come up with the term Ellis Island.
Right.
A friend of mine did.
Right.
I won't take credit for that.
Right.
But Nashville was occupied and Tennessee was occupied very early in the Civil War. If you remember, the Civil War is 1861 to 1865. So with Nashville being occupied in early 1862, it became, people who were enslaved saw the federal government as a place of refuge, saw the federal army as a place of refuge, a place that they could run to and maybe take refuge behind Union lines. Nashville became that place, and that's why with so many troops stationed in Nashville, people have referred to it as an Ellis Island. Also, if you think about the ways to get into Nashville, the transportation routes. We have the railroads, we have the water, we have all the turnpikes. It was also an easy place to get to. And there's a huge military presence here. So when I first started learning about this, I thought that it would just be a few people running from enslavement to the Union Army. But then as I started reading primary accounts from missionaries, a lot. Missionaries came from the north to the south. Methodist missionaries, Presbyterian missionaries, and the Union Army, General Grant, tasked John Eaton, one of these missionaries, with doing something with refugees, because it was thousands of people running from enslavement to potentially claim freedom and liberty in Nashville. Although, we have to remember that Tennessee, being an occupied state, did not fall under the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. That only applied to Confederate states. So Tennessee's story is very interesting in terms of people running from enslavement, because they have no standing as being either emancipated or they were not slaves. So they're in this very liminal space during that period, this very who are we, what are we space. And it's a very, and they, you know, the finally emancipation happened in 1865 after the end of the war for those African Americans.
So there were not only soldiers living on that site, but was it a camp? Was there an encampment there of refugees, as it were?
During that period, there were several what we call contraband camps in Nashville, refugee camps. of African Americans that were set up by the Union Army. Some of them, according to the reports I've read, they weren't managed very well. But one of the refugee camps developed near Fort Negley. And these are thousands of people. This is not, you know, a camp of 15 people. This is thousands of people. So people in these refugee camps were doing jobs for the soldiers, doing laundry, cooking food and the like. Others, the men, were impressed into the USCT or the US Colored Troops. So they were mustering into that too. So there was an actually African American regiment in this area. And so archaeology is really difficult to find archaeological deposits from like a very ephemeral, you know, like a 4-year period or 2-year period, but we know that they exist. And the first step is to identify where the likely deposits are. And then if you run into something, you can say, oh, this relates to this. So a very good example is Camp Contraband in Chattanooga. Know exactly where it is. And it was on, it's on, you know, near the railroad on the river, and it's in a park area. And they were going to do some excavation, some construction in that area, called in the archaeologists. And since we knew where those, where that camp was, this archaeologist was able to tie the archaeological remains to that contraband camp, to that camp. So it was very important. So one of the things I've been trying to do at the Fullerton Laboratory for Spatial Technology and Sciences is to map those locations of the contraband camps and other African American sites in the Civil War. Historians, archaeologists, we haven't turned our perspective, we haven't until recently, to African American archaeological sites. Certainly we've looked at slave cabins and that type of things on plantations, but to look at that geography in the post-emancipation landscape is like a new field of study. But it's something that it's important to the American story, and with the 150th anniversary of the Civil War that we just recently commemorated, it's something that people have been really looking at more. So we have tried in Tennessee to map that African American experience, and so far we've mapped 180 locations, and there's still more to be discovered.
Are those resources available to people on the internet, or how can they access those?
Yes, well, one of the things that we did at Fullerton Lab is map the Civil War sites, the Civil War conflict sites in Tennessee, and that's the Tennessee Civil War GIS.
Okay.
So we mapped that. It's an interactive online free map,
okay,
where you can click on a conflict and it brings up the primary documents, the primary sources, just the sources that were written during the period. And you can click on that and read what the official reports of it. What we also did is put an African American geography layer on that too. So you can also click on African American sites and bring up information. So for example, USCT recruitment sites, and you can click on one
Colored
of those
troops,
right? Mm-hmm. and you can bring up the advertisement from the newspaper showing where those were. You can click on one of the hospital sites and find information on that. So we tried to put in, you know, not secondary, don't put in information that other people, that historians have written about it. We have digital sources, and they have to be digital too. That was one of our rules. They have to be digital, and that's becoming more and more possible.
Incredible. I know that there is an organization called the Friends of Fort Negley, and I encourage our listeners to go online and look at their website, because there are lots of nice pictures of aerial views and all that sort of thing of Fort Negley that would go along with our interview here today. I wanted to ask you this. There's been a dust-up more recently about the cutting of the vegetation off of the side of that hill up there. Are you familiar with that issue, or what are your thoughts about that?
I am familiar with that issue, and the vegetation has been cut several times over the history of the site. So the fort was a park. It was opened as a park by the WPA in 1940, and then it was closed during World War II and basically became overgrown. There were efforts at the 100th anniversary of the Civil War to open it up again, and then at various points the vegetation has been cut off. When I first got involved with the fort in 1995 and 96 for the master plan, there was a lot of bush honeysuckle and other type of invasives that were all over the rock walls of the fort. And I think one thing I want to make everybody understand is that this fort is what we call dry stack stone masonry. So there's no mortar in it. So it's not like your brick wall where you put mortar and concrete and stuff in it. It's basically held together by gravity. It's a gravity wall.
Okay.
And it's also built on a steep hill. And it was never built to last 150 years. Maybe James St. Clair Morton hoped it would. I don't know what he was thinking, but I doubt if he would have thought it would have existed 150 years in the future. So now we have dry stack stone masonry, rebuilt in part by the WPA, also dry stack stone masonry, and you have all these freeze thaw cycles. It's built on clay. Clay is not the most stable type of substrate, type of matrix soil.
Right.
I'm using technical terms.
Right.
And I know that people can see it now. Now that in this most recent tree cutting, if people can see it, I'm able to see the landscape better. In fact, I've been able to see and identify some features that previously I only thought were there by using remote sensing, and now I can see them. You know, just because I didn't want to crawl on my belly in bush honeysuckle to try to find it.
Right.
I'm a technical advisor about the fort to the Board of Parks and Recreation. It's unclear to me what's going to happen to the fort structure now without the tree canopy that was there, whether there will be more, whether the freeze-thaw cycle will affect it. That said, the Metro Historical Commission several years ago commissioned what we call a historic structures report. They got a grant to get one of the best historic preservation firms in the country to take a look at the fort and make recommendations for that, for conserving the fort. I mean, it is multiple acres big. You know, it takes millions of dollars. The other thing you're
just to keep the grass cut.
Just to keep the grass cut, yes.
Money, right.
Well, maybe not that much, but a lot to keep the grass cut. In fact, they're doing something very innovative at Fort Negley right now. They're using sheep to cut the grass. A very passive way to do that.
Yeah.
But Fort Negley, the park, and the fort itself is owned by the city of Nashville. It's not owned by the state. It's not owned by the National Park Service. It's owned by the city, and the city budget has to pay for police, teachers, fire, new streets. There's a lot of competing resources on a city's budget. And this, you know, the city has made, I think, very good efforts getting this historic structures report done by an excellent firm. The firm made recommendations. One of the recommendations was a geotechnical study to understand what the footing was. There's not a lot of footers that this fort was built on. It's built on bedrock. And so they've done the geotechnical study. They've gone to get the money. They've asked to have money for the next phase of stabilization and repairs. So they're proceeding with that. But again, it takes time. they can't just wave a magic wand. They have to go through budget cycles and make budget requests.
Well, I'm, you know, there was a homeless camp there on that property for several years.
And yes.
They've had some issues with having to close that down. And, of course, the vegetation there was, as you said, thick with bush honeysuckle, with the Elianthus mm-hmm. tree of heaven bush, privet hedge, a lot of invasives there. And they were providing a way of shielding from view the homeless camp that was there. And I guess part of the reason for the tree cutting was to eliminate the place for the homeless to hide.
I don't know. Yeah, I really, yeah. truly don't know the rationale yeah. behind the tree cutting. It was done when yeah. it was done, and I...
Cutting down bush honeysuckle is a good thing just about any time you want to do it, as far as in my view.
It's hard to keep it from coming back.
Exactly.
I visited the homeless camp several times mm-hmm. and walked it, actually mapped it, mm-hmm. and because it's part of the cultural occupation of that site. And I know that there was just a lot of compassion from the city and from the people who worked at Fort Negley towards the people who lived there. And but it was growing, and there were some issues with the behavior, and it is a public park.
Exactly. Well, Zeta Law, thank you for coming in and talking with us today. I will hopefully have you back sometime, and we can do some talking about some music. How about that?
I would love to do that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right.